Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we step away from summer movies and over to television documentary. ESPN recently made its most ambitious documentary ever, a 7+ hour examination of the story of O.J. Simpson. We'll talk about how well it works and what's left to say about a story so exhaustively covered. Our second segment is much, much lighter. We'll be bringing you the quiz segment from our May live show in New York featuring our friend, Audie Cornish. Plus, as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before we start, I want to introduce you to NPR Music's discovery podcast, Alt Latino. Hosts Felix Contreras and Jasmine Garst are your guides into the worlds of Latino arts and culture, and this isn't some stodgy museum tour. Alternative approaches to traditional music, interviews with cultural icons like Rita Moreno and Carlos Santana, as well as contemporary vanguards like Calle Trece and Juno Diaz. Find Alt Latino in the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcast.
We've got smart documentary film and lots more on this week's show. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And in our fourth chair this week is our dear friend Gene Demby. Gene, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger and co-host of Code Switch.
That's yes. Right.
Oh,
if you have not heard this in countless NPR promos and from our boundless enthusiasm, the Code Switch podcast, which many of you have waited for so long, has finally launched. But enough about the Code Switch podcast. First on our agenda this week, ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary series has looked at everything from the death of Len Bias to the collapse of the USFL. That's a really good one, by the way, the collapse of the USFL. It recently debuted a very long-form documentary called O.J. Made in America. It begins with O.J. Simpson's college football career, follows him through his 1995 murder trial. You've probably heard he was acquitted, and then traces the path to his 2008 conviction for kidnapping and armed robbery that landed him in prison, where he still is, by the way. Director Ezra Edelman didn't have access to Simpson, but he did have access to people like Marcia Clark and many of Simpson's friends and business associates, so let's talk about this film a little bit. So, Gene, we should first clarify, this is a director that you know a little.
Mm-hmm. He's a friend of a friend. I got a chance to see the documentary, like, not very much before
right.
You guys got to see it, but
right.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to this when you first sat down and kind of watched this whole thing?
I think I texted you, but you were the first person I wanted to speak to because I know you've been such a big proponent of the FX miniseries on the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yes, called The People vs. O.J. Simpson,
right.
American Crime Story.
It's so weird that those things happened in proximity to each other. But the very first episode, I was interested in this, but the thing I'd never gotten about this trial, like when this happened, I was 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And when O.J. Simpson was being arrested, it was like during the Bronco Chiefs. I remember it was during the Knicks and the Rockets in the finals. My mom was like, this dude doesn't bang with black people. Like, it was like, he's not, like, why are we being sympathetic to him? And I never sort of understood the depth of sort of alienation that O.J. had, like, actively cultivated. I mean, he wanted to be as far away from black people as possible. Yeah. I didn't understand why my mom and a bunch of boomers, like, why they had so much contempt for O.J. Simpson. And it wasn't until this documentary that sort of got a larger, sort of, like, a much more context around who he was. I didn't appreciate that he was essentially the first black sports hero who became a really successful national pitchman.
Right.
And he did that by really, really pointedly avoiding any sort of, like, saying anything about racial politics in America.
Yeah, there's a part of this where they talk about the fact that as he was very successful, particularly when he was in college, football was, you know, this is the late 60s, and not only is it the civil rights movement, you know, still in full swing, but you also have specifically black athletes at that time, like Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali.
Bill Russell.
Right, and other folks who were trying to take a more actively political stance as black athletes. And this is where you hear that line that he supposedly said, which is the, I'm not black, I'm OJ.
And, you know, USC is right next to Watts, right? I mean, and so the Watts riots blow up, and he's very conspicuously silent and quiet about it. There's that great picture that was circulating last week as it pertained to Ali, and actually pops up in this documentary. It's, you know, Ali and Russell and Jim Brown, and then you see John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the Olympics with their fists in the air. And OJ was very, very, like, very much avoiding that. And I didn't realize how much enmity he had created, like, among a lot of black folks because he was so sort of, like, studiously avoiding that stuff. But, like, it became a template, actually, for, I mean, this is the Michael Jordan template, right? Like, mm-hmm. to sort of avoid any sort of being controversial in any way.
Yeah.
The documentary also sort of juxtaposes OJ sort of, I'm a good, likable black dude who is, I'm not even a black dude, I'm just OJ, right?
Yeah.
He was probably the only black dude in LA who had no problems with the police. Like, who was that?
Yeah.
And he actively cultivated this relationship with them. And that sort of comes up later in the allegations of domestic violence against Nicole Brown Simpson. It's really damning in a way that is not, doesn't seem like cheap or mean-spirited at all,
right?
But it shows him as someone who is like kind of craven, right? I mean, or at least just really self-involved and sort of disinterested in the wider world that he was. And obviously all that stuff comes to bear on his trial and his life later on.
Yeah, it's fascinating to listen to, you know, there are tapes, there are 911 tapes, I think they are, of her sort of saying, you guys never do anything. Like, how come you guys never do? And I think, or maybe it's a police report.
Mm-hmm.
There's information in the documentary that she sort of complained, how come you guys come out here and out here, you never do anything.
Right, right.
And so it's so ironic to think that later the story became so much about allegations that they were kind of out to get, the police were kind of out to get him, when in the context, at least, of the relationship with her, her feeling was, no matter how many times I call you, you never do anything. What was your reaction to this, Glenn?
I just admired the hell out of it. It is so rigorously constructed.
Sure.
And from a storytelling standpoint, every time it widens out, it widens way the hell out. And you spend a little bit of time thinking, why am I learning about this right now? And then there's just payoff after payoff after payoff. That raised fist thing comes back in.
Right.
And, you know, documentaries like this one aren't scripted. They are edited. And so again and again, this guy found the right shot to accompany some piece of dialogue from somebody. We see, you know, him saying that when he was in Buffalo, he didn't get that kind of Hollywood attention he wanted. And there's a shot of him talking to a couple nuns on a street. And he said, and somebody else at some point says, he became entitled. And we cut to a shot of him kissing wads of cash. It's like, yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating to see, Gene, over and over again, every single crowd shot, every party he is attended, he is the only black person
in the room.
And over. They have so much footage, much documentary footage of just him being the one black guy.
Oh, and there's this fascinating scene that I did not know about. And I was in my, early 20s when this trial happened. I followed it pretty closely. I felt like I knew more than I needed to know.
Sure. Yeah. Right, right.
And yet, I'm constantly picking up details I either have long since forgotten or didn't know. And one of them was the defense in the murder trial walks the jury through the house.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
His house.
And they have been able to, or allowed to, prepare the house, replacing all these, not all of them, but replacing a bunch of pictures of OJ with, like, white businessmen, OJ with white friends. They were saying in the documentary, like, people were saying, like, they found every photo that had ever been taken of OJ with a black person and hung them around his house to make it appear that he was more enmeshed in the black community than he was.
And there's a conversation about that with Carl Douglas, one of his defense lawyers, who says, if it had been a Latino jury, I would have found a picture of him in a sombrero. Like, you talk about you talk about something that seems, you know, quite craven.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I thought was remarkable about this, too, and I wrote a long piece about this documentary for the blog, but one of the things that really stood out to me was the description of him being the first black member of a country club in New Jersey and bringing Sidney Poitier to play. And I think it's the guy from Hertz who says, oh, I brought him to these places that black men really didn't go. When he brought Sidney Poitier to play golf at the club, even the bigots thought that was terrific.
Yeah.
and it's such an amazing, and he says it with a certain dry, he understands what he's saying.
Sure.
But that much of the pull of this story is racial politics versus or alongside the politics of celebrity.
Right.
Yeah. And so he is very specifically laying out, as clearly as one can, for the people he's talking about, it was more important that he was famous than it was that he was a black guy, him and Sidney Poitier both.
You mentioned there's a bunch of stuff about, like, the Watts riots and a lot of the history of racial politics in L.A. And watching it, I remember my first thought as they go on what appears to be a tangent. And I remember thinking, gosh, this is really interesting, but why are they doing this? This is about OJ. And you realize that part of what they're laying out, part of this massive mosaic of this piece, is they are laying out how the verdict happened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so much, I think, of the retelling of this story is like, that verdict and how controversial that verdict was and how you come up with that verdict. And you get this larger sense that that verdict was part of this huge continuum in terms of how this city related to its citizens.
Right. It almost seemed inevitable, right? Like, when you watch it, the way he sort of lays it out is that there's this long history of just, like, antagonism by the police of Black people and just antagonism by the criminal justice system of Black people in L.A. And you get that. I mean, some of the jurors who speak on camera sort of say, like, one woman in particular, who is just really colorful, and she says that it's sort of payback. Like, the verdict in part was sort of like a way to stick it to the city. And it's really easy to see the verdict as illegitimate in the context of the courtroom, right? But in the context of, like, the city itself, it seems like almost like there was no other way that that could have turned out.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also very important when you look at any criminal trial to keep in mind how, and I think the documentary does a very good job of laying this out, that prosecutors have an extraordinarily high burden of proof.
Right.
And you see it in this story, the difference between what you have to do in a criminal trial and what they later did in the civil trial. For one thing, you can make somebody testify. You can call somebody to testify in a civil trial. You cannot call them as a witness against themselves in a criminal trial.
Right.
But that burden of proof on the prosecution is extremely high. And there are some candid moments with Marcia Clark in particular, I think, where she comes very close to acknowledging that, although she starts off saying, she says something like, it's the most evidence I've ever seen in a case ever, which I don't know if that's literally what she's saying, but she felt there was an abundance of evidence. But I think she would acknowledge as she goes through it, she understands how at least some of that evidence came to be undermined by
Mark Furman.
Right. Mark Furman, the detective who had discovered most importantly, a glove with blood on it at O.J. Simpson's home. And there was a lot of history about his interactions with Black people and what he had said about those interactions. And then eventually there were tapes that came out in which he was using, you know, racial slurs that he said he never used.
Right.
Said on the stand that he had never
used. Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think even she would acknowledge that a lot of that evidence came to be undermined. And among other things, I think the documentary does a really good job of explaining, look, one thing that happened here was a really gifted and well-funded defense team that was very good at poking holes in a case from a bunch of different angles, some of which were these kind of big picture questions and some of which were bringing in really, you know, people who knew everything about blood evidence to try to explain that perhaps it had been mishandled or whatever.
Well, one of the things, I mean, you brought up Mark Furman briefly, and one of the things I found so interesting about this documentary is how many of the people that they are able to talk to. And obviously, they don't get O.J. Simpson.
Right.
There are certain, you know, several principals have died, like Johnny Cochran.
Sure. They don't get Darden.
They don't get Darden.
Yeah, Darden, I think, has kind of...
Darden, one of the main prosecutors, who was very controversial at the time. But they do get very, I thought, candid, compelling, really compelling interviews with people like Furman.
Yeah.
I thought the Mark Furman interview almost had an arc to it.
Yeah.
Like there was an arc to it within the arc of this larger story, and found him just very, very interesting to watch. Like, what an interesting and totally derailed life.
Yeah.
You know,
which is what he sort of says himself.
Yeah.
He kind of says, I had everything and now I have nothing, which of course he sees as a victimization of him, and
right,
a lot of people undoubtedly wouldn't.
It's amazing after watching 7.5 hours of this thing that there's still parts of the story that I don't get, that I don't understand, that I want to hear more about.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. There is a passing mention of the fact that at least one of his friends believes O.J.'s father was gay.
Mm-hmm.
Comes and goes. It's
mentioned a couple times.
It's mentioned a couple times, but in 7.5 hours, I thought if you raise it, you have to spend a little bit more time just on some of the ramifications of that.
Well, Nicole sort of says, right, or someone says that Nicole said that she wondered if he, like, reacted violently to the fact that their young children were around gay men, because he never talked about it, and it seemed to be a thing that she knew and that his friends knew.
Yeah. It's a thing that clearly was raised by people who knew him and knew her, whether there was some relationship between if in fact he had, you know, didn't like it when she had them, the kids around.
And maybe I just want to play armchair psychiatrist. It might just be that silly.
Sure.
It might just be like just
Also
the fact that his daughter died in the pool in the backyard mentioned goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think that would be a much bigger part of the story.
I thought about that too. But I think what I admire so much about this documentary is exactly the way that there's this one giant story and they figure out a way to kind of make it a bunch of smaller stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
The story of the jury's reactions, I think, to Chris Darden, who, as we mentioned, was one of the prosecutors, was a youngish black man who wasn't involved in the case originally and then kind of came on to the case, which at least one of the jurors says that she found kind of suspicious and pandering.
Yeah.
And she kind of was like, do you think I'm stupid? Do you think I don't understand that you now have brought a black guy onto this case who may or may not, in her eyes, be qualified? He's here to impress me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. At which point she seems to have put additional pressure on him to perform well. I want to talk a little bit about that last sequence. After the trial, after even the civil trial, he winds up in Florida for a period of time. What?
There's a This American Life episode about, you know, you see him in this documentary with the pimp hat on and like dancing with these women around him. There's a This American Life episode about how that came to be. Apparently, like, there was some weird like thing called juiced. It was supposed to be like punked, where it's like, you've been juiced.
Yeah. You've been juiced. And it's like him selling oranges on the side of the road. It's like pranks involving O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
I think there's a certain amount of...
Quite a bunch of noises we're making there.
I think there was a certain amount of he reached a point in his career where he's taking what's offered to him.
Sure.
And that winds up sending him into less and less reputable circles, which of course culminates in that bizarre
incident where he winds up going back to prison, yeah.
Carl Douglas has this really interesting point that he makes about that trial, where he says, that crime is a two-year crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of crime, you do that crime, you go to jail for 2 years.
He says it's a two-year crime soaking wet.
Soaking wet.
Which is fun.
He's so interesting. And he wound up getting 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
You come out, like, almost kind of making this point, like, do two wrongs make a right if you feel that he should have been in jail all along?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many conclusions. I don't even want to spoil them, but there's so many conclusions. The show ended, and I just stared blankly at the credits
and thought
about, like, wow, different people here are coming to some very different conclusions about what this represents.
It is so complex.
I want to bring up a scene that I haven't heard talked about very much that is probably the one that has stuck with me the most. They make a decision late in the fourth episode to just have somebody from the DA's office lay out exactly what they feel happened.
Right. What
their theory is with the murders. And with this very sober reading of the events, they cut to some of the goriest crime scene photos that I have ever
seen.
That's
when they reveal really the crime scene photos for the first time.
I do not seek out crime scene photos.
No.
Sure.
And for those who are interested in this, be prepared that particularly in this fourth episode, there are images that they show that are unbelievably graphic.
And when you reach that sequence, if that's not something that you want to see, that's a good time to kind of go to the audio.
To be ready to turn away. Because, and I think the decision that Ezra Edelman makes to show that is very clearly, I think, built around the idea, like, look, it's very easy to get caught up in the circus over here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's really break down, like, what has happened to these people?
Sure.
And, like, we're still talking about an unbelievably horrifying crime.
Right.
And
whether you think they proved he did it or not.
It's a very, very disturbing crime. And you get a full view and a full understanding of what we're talking about here. And I found, as upset as I was by those images and as much as I kind of want to unsee those images, they're very important. And there was clearly, I think, a lot of thought put into including them.
Sure.
Yeah. And I keep coming back to the fact that this was the most covered news story pretty much in American history. And yet, I just spent 7.5 hours with it, which I found enlightening.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to conservatively say that Gene and I have already spent 2 to 2.5 hours at my desk talking about this series. So as you can tell, we could talk about this for many, many hours and unfortunately can't. I'm sure you'll be able to find it on replays. There are a couple of episodes left as this drops on ESPN. And then I'm sure that it will replay and be available on demand and in various places. They also gave it a theatrical screening to qualify it for Oscars, and you'll see it in various, I think, awards cycles.
Yeah.
It's extremely powerful and beautifully done. So thanks to all you guys for sitting chatting with me about it. In our second segment, we are going to have something a little bit different. We're going to have
something more than a little bit different.
Yeah, we are. We're going to have our live quiz from our show in New York in May. So come right back for that.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo understands that you work hard to get the most out of life. From starting a business to saving for retirement, there are a lot of things you want to accomplish. Working together, Wells Fargo will take the time to understand what you're trying to achieve to help you reach your financial goals. That way you can care for the people and things that matter most. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together we'll go far.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Our first segment, as you know, if you listened, was pretty heavy. This one is going to be pretty light. We are so happy to report that the episode that you're listening to is our 300th fall episode since we started the show.
Woo.
That does not count small batches, by the way. So this seemed like as good a time as any for some lighthearted entertainment. So we are bringing you the quiz that we recently did during our live show at the Vulture Festival in New York on May 22nd. Stephen and Glenn and our friend Audie Cornish took some questions from me about short-lived television, very short-lived television. In fact, so let's take a listen to that. So the quiz that we are going to have today is about TV shows that ran either one episode or no episodes. Now, we're not talking here about busted pilots. We're talking about things that they actually committed to run and make, and then maybe they never happened, or maybe they only happened for one day.
Wow.
And then they were over. Mm. I have a total of 12 questions, so you will each get 4. I trust you all on the honor system to keep your own score. If you can use your fingers if necessary. All right, Stephen Thompson.
Yes, Linda.
On January 8th, 2005, CBS ran the only episode of The Will, in which 10 of a multimillionaire's friends and relatives competed to be the beneficiaries of his will.
Vaguely
true
remember this.
True story.
Vaguely remember this.
While the final episode never aired on CBS, it eventually surfaced on the Fox Reality Channel.
Awesome.
And revealed the winner to be whom. Now, for this information, I fortunately found a review from the New York Times of the first and only episode, which explains who all the characters were, so I will be leaning on those characterizations in these options. So, revealed the winner to be whom. His last name was Long. Long's fourth wife, Penny, described by the New York Times as a harridan. Scott, described in the same review as Penny's fat brother.
Wow.
Ashley, described in the same review as Penny's twerpy son. Or Kristen, a former girlfriend of the twerpy son, who the review notes boasts happily about her sham breasts.
Wow.
So is it
New York Times is throwing some shade. Right?
They were. Who became the beneficiary of the will?
Well, it sounds like whoever did get that, it was incredibly highly deserving.
Yes.
I am going to say that awful, awful harridan, his wife.
That is correct.
Yes.
It is the harridan.
Oh, come on.
The correct answer is the harridan. 1 point for Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, a year later, on January 9th, 2006, ABC ran one episode of Emily's Reasons Why Not.
Okay.
Some fans of Emily's Reasons Why Not. Starring Heather Graham as a woman who vows to break up with any guy if she can think of 5 reasons why she should. In the first episode, what happens to her latest relationship? Is it A, she thinks the guy is gay, but he's just a devout Mormon? B, she learns that the guy listens to public radio? C, she finds out that the guy once dated her mother? Or D, she discovers that the guy brushes his teeth with vodka? So, gay but just a Mormon, listens to public radio, dated her mother, or brushes his teeth with vodka.
All right. Well, no jury in the world is going to convict anybody on gay versus Mormon. I'm going to go with dated
her
mom.
Mother. No, it's actually the gay but Mormon. Yeah. She thought he was gay, but it turned out he was just a devout Mormon. I'm sure it was a very sensitive portrayal. of both.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, Audie Cornish. CBS canceled
Secret Talents of the Stars, which is exactly what you think it is.
Okay.
After only one episode in 2008, had it run all season, it would have featured all of these secret talents except for one. That I made up. All right. Is it A, Sheila E. juggling? B, Ben Stein dancing the jitterbug? C, Marla Maples doing gymnastics? Or D, Danny Bonaducci on trapeze?
Oh my God.
Sheila E. juggling,
the
Ben
Stein. The thing is, I feel like I've seen these people perform these things on like Circus of the Stars. Like,
doesn't it feel like talents. This is something you should actually
yeah,
know?
Yeah, like this actually seems like something I should know. I'm going to go with one of them doesn't exist.
Correct.
God, they're also really actually critical.
Three of them would have been real had it run its course, which is what's so sad.
Maybe the first one?
Sheila E. juggling?
Yeah.
No, the correct answer is Danny Bonaducci on trapeze. Huh. He was actually scheduled to ride a unicycle. Sorry,
it did seem like something he would really do.
I can't. I think that's a confusing question. It's, you knew he was going in with the circus folk.
Yeah, so what you're saying is I should take a point and I
will.
No.
Fox's, Stephen, Fox's 2007 comedy-reality hybrid Anchorwoman made it to two episodes on a technicality since they aired back-to-back on the same night, but we're still including it. It followed Lauren Jones as she tried to become a news anchor in Texas. Jones's credits included being Miss New York, working as a WWE diva, and what other job? Is it A, hosting an MTV Spring Break special? Is it B, working as a Barker's Beauty on The Price is Right? Is it C, demonstrating dance moves on instructional videos? Or is it D, being a reporter?
All right, so I'm gonna try to break this down. What network was this on? I'm serious. No, this is. I have a plan, people.
Fox.
I have a process.
Fox.
All right,
Fox.
So she's probably not a Barker's Beauty on CBS's The Price is Right. I like to rule these things out.
All right.
I am going to say that her one of her wild professions is that she was... Give them to me again. I'm so sorry.
MTV Spring Break Special, uh-huh. Barker's Beauty, demonstrating dance moves on instructional videos or being a reporter.
Dance moves.
She was a Barker's Beauty.
I need to just assume that whichever one I disqualify out of hand is the one.
I'm waiting for you to catch on to that, but you never do.
We've done like 300 episodes. I'll get there.
Glenn.
Yes.
Fox's Manchester Prep was part of its effort to capitalize both on the popularity of teen soaps like Dawson's Creek, May It Rest in Peace, and on movies like Cruel Intentions, which was its direct inspiration. After the network reportedly freaked out about how freaky sexy it was, I tried to find a way to explain to you what it was, the scene that was widely reported that was freaky sexy, but I think it's actually too hot for our podcast. I think they actually wouldn't want to run the podcast if I explained it to you too directly, so see me at the meet and greet and I'll explain it to you. The network reportedly freaked out about how freaky sexy it was. What happened to the episodes that never aired? A, an unhappy producer released them on bootleg DVDs. B, they were recut into a movie released as Cruel Intentions 2. C, they are currently unavailable in any form. D, they aired on Bravo.
All right, logically they would air on Bravo. I don't think you can just slap a name onto a thing and release it as a movie, so I'm gonna go with A.
It actually is Cruel Intentions 2.
Damn it.
Yeah. They made it into Cruel Intentions 2.
Huh.
Audie. The 2006 NBC comedy Thick and Thin, never made it to air at all. What was it about? A. We're gonna have fun. What was it about? A woman who lost more than 50 pounds. B, a chubby man and his skinny wife. C, a detective named Roger Thick and his canine partner, a greyhound named Thin. D, a couple that had remarried each other 4 times.
Hmm.
Oh, I get it, Thick and Thin.
Yeah.
Oh, God. All of them sound like really bad TV shows.
Yeah.
It's a wonder it never
Woman Who Lost 450 Pounds, Chubby Man, a Skinny Wife, Roger Thick, and the Greyhound named Thin. Couple that remarried each other 4 times.
I'm going to go with the marriage one.
It is actually The Woman Who Lost More Than 50 Pounds. And this show is...
I was hoping it wouldn't be so literal.
This show was created by Paula Pell, if you know who Paula Pell is. That was probably going to be a good show. I'm just saying.
Right.
But yeah, Thick and Thin. Woman Who Lost a Bunch of Weight. That's what it was about. She was thick.
And now...
I'm sure it would have been a sensitive portrayal.
Of both, yeah. All right. Steven, scheduled for 2006, the singles table was centered around strangers who met where? A, a New Year's Eve party. B, an anniversary party. C, a wedding. D, a children's birthday party.
I mean, stuff like wedding is a little too obvious.
No, I learned. Learn from me.
I'm going to prove my ability to immediately rule out the answer. But I'm going to say children's birthday party.
No, it's the wedding.
Why?
You told yourself.
Exactly.
And then she told you. And you didn't listen to either of you. Here's the background on this show. This show was actually going to star John Cho as well as Alicia Silverstone. Why did they not make this show?
Yeah.
This is my question. Put it on the air anyway.
Right.
Glenn, in 1995, CBS shot but never aired 6 episodes of a comedy starring Dolly Parton. What was the title and premise? A, Dolly Parton plays a lounge singer named Betsy who has a near-death experience in Heavens to Betsy.
Mm. Pretty good. Pretty good.
B, Parton plays a preacher's wife named Grace in Say Grace. C, Parton plays a football coach's wife named Mary in Hail Mary.
Oh.
Or D, Parton plays a woman named Belle who is a celebrity impersonator in Belle is Other People.
Ah.
We need more existentialism jokes.
Yeah.
Feeling about the show.
I'm going to go ahead and eliminate the Sart pun from network television. I think you're probably safer doing that than I would have been.
I think so. You don't hire Dolly Parton without having her do some singing. Lounge singer.
You are correct.
Very good, man.
All right, Audie Cornish.
Yes.
CBS pulled a reality series from Titan, Mark Burnett, in 2008 that would have seen contestants competing to do what? A, write ad jingles. B, make websites. C, build log cabins. Or D, make workout videos.
And this is a thing that existed.
Yes.
Existed,
I mean,
but
it never actually
never
was on, but they were going to make it, and then they didn't.
Maybe the one about the log cabin building? They like doing stuff.
So you're going to go with log cabins?
I think so.
It's the ad jingles. Oh. It was called Jingles.
That's basically just The Apprentice, though.
Yeah,
that's like
yes, that's a sub-part of The Apprentice.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
All right.
Steven, not long ago, in 2014, ABC pulled the plug on the drama series Members Only, which followed the wealthy Holmes family. After the departure of what original collaborator? They canceled it after what original collaborator bailed out?
Okay.
Was it David Chase of The Sopranos, David Simon of The Wire, David O. Russell of American Hustle, or David E. Kelly of Ally McBeal, et cetera?
Picket fences. The most likely one is going to be David E. Kelly.
It was David O. Russell.
Huh. What?
David O. Russell was going to work on Members Only with, I believe, John Stamos. Glenn, back in 2005, the WB, you remember the WB?
I do.
Declined to move forward with a show in which Jane Leaves played a woman who tracked down the sperm donor she'd used to have her teenage daughter. What was the show called? Was it A, Oh Baby? Was it B, Number 21806? Was it C, Misconceptions?
Mm.
Or was it D, Thaw?
A and D, C is too high-minded.
Okay.
A and D are right down the middle.
But the one that's intriguing to me is the number. What's
number 21806?
Number 21806. Well, it's a little too Les Mis. So. Why am I overthinking? Oh, baby.
Yeah.
It's misconceptions.
Damn it.
All right, Audie. It is remarkable that Fox did not air a planned reality series which sent 12 women and 12 men off to an island together, but perhaps easier to understand when you know that the premise was what? A, they were required to form couples each week and then live together as nudists. That's A. B, they were competing to be named most manly and most womanly. Was it C, the men were required to be subservient to the women? Or was it D, the men were not permitted to speak? I call that last one pop culture happy.
No, Audie. They're not going to do the one where men don't talk because... I'm going to say it's not that.
Because people would have watched that.
I think the nude one. That sounds like Blur. You know, yep. Do you remember like that?
Like Naked and Afraid.
That would
naked
happen. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's the men were required to be subservient to the women.
Huh.
It was going to be called When Women Rule the World or something like that.
Huh.
That was the plan. Yeah. So that those are your 12 questions. Right. Where do we wind up? You have one.
One.
Yeah, I have nothing.
Yep.
That's pretty
I think
much
that
how all
a,
of these quizzes
that
go.
Might be a mark of your intelligence in this case. All right.
Your winner.
Yay.
And share the victory. All right, we are going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we're going to do our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Moon Travel Guides, publisher of Moon Route 66 Road Trip by Green Book scholar and travel writer Candace Taylor. With unique turn-by-turn driving routes and advice on the best sites to visit, including historical details about the significance of the route to African-American travelers during the Jim Crow era, Moon Route 66 Road Trip gives the experiential traveler the tools to plan a more personal and memorable road trip. Visit moon.com/radio to learn more.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I have postscripts for two things that were mentioned in last week's What's Making Me Happy segment. One is that Margaret H. Willison saw the production of Hadestown that is playing at the New York Theater Workshop until the end of July in New York City. I got to see it last weekend, and I thought it was terrific. It is Aeneas Mitchell's folk opera retelling the Orpheus and Eurydice myth, which I would break down to a Greek myth about cautionary tale regarding dating musicians.
Sure.
And I thought it was terrific, really enjoyed that. And also I mentioned that I was starting to do some Facebook Live stuff, did a Facebook Live session with Barry Hardiman talking about parenting. Later in the week, unbeknownst to me when we were taping last week's episode, we also did a What's Making Us Happy segment. Glenn Weldon, our pal Bob Mondello, the film critic for NPR, and myself, we sat down on a little couch and talked about what was making us happy that week. Wound up talking for about 40 minutes. If you want to know why we value Jessica Reedy, our producer, as much as we do, watch us unedited on live video. But it was a very, very fun segment, and we got some nice feedback on it. I'm assuming we're going to probably do that some more. So keep watching your Facebook Live as we experiment and come up with new ways to embarrass ourselves on camera.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
His new graphic novel, which isn't, in fact, a novel. It's Paul Dini's autobiography with art by Eduardo Risso, who did a series called 100 Bullets, which I liked a lot. It's called Dark Knight, with no K, just night as in, not day. Dark Knight, a true Batman story. Wow. Paul Dini was a writer and producer for many animated series and many other things, but he, pursuant to this story, he was the writer and producer for Batman, the animated series back in the 90s. And while
Gene is nodding,
yes,
more than approving.
Oh, so good.
While working on that show, he was brutally attacked and mugged in L.A.
Oh, wow.
And this is about the events leading up to that moment and the events after it. The conceit of this book is that all his feelings of self-loathing and depression become personified in his head as various Batman supervillains, and Batman appears to him, remonstrating him for you should have stepped up,
you should have done.
If I was there, I would have done X, Y, and Z, like all that. And while that may make it sound kind of tidy and overdetermined and
right,
too neat, every time I started to feel that, it would go to a place that was really raw and real and powerful. So that interplay and how that event changed him is what the book's about. That's Dark Knight, a true Batman story.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. That sounds awesome. Fascinating.
I definitely
to
want
me.
To watch it.
Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week, sir?
So last week, I got to see Beyonce in concert.
Yeah, you did.
Man.
It was actually my first stadium concert ever. Jess Riddy went to see her, I guess, a few weeks ago in mm-hmm. Santa Clara, and she said it was amazing. She said it was the best show she's seen since Hamilton. She wasn't lying. A couple years ago, Questlove started like a Twitter war when he said that, you know, Beyonce is the closest thing we have to Michael Jackson, right? Like, sort of like in an age we're not supposed to have a monoculture anymore, right?
Yeah.
Like, here's this person who is sort of like the biggest pop star in the world, mm-hmm. and she's like on his level as a performer. And a lot of people are like, that's impossible. But it actually isn't. I mean, actually, having seen her live, I mean, some of it just, I mean, the thing that you notice, I mean, this is sort of her brand at this point, is like how much effort she always like, look how hard I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
She just always seems like almost superhuman. Like, you know, the concert is just beautifully constructed. And she's 35, but she has this 18 years of music now, right? She's on, what, album 6 or 7 or something like that. It was a fascinating cultural experience. One, I mean, it was probably the only time you'll ever go to a football stadium and, like, there not be a line for the men's room. just no line at all. It was probably conservatively, like, 90% female. She's a fantastic dancer, but she's also a fantastic singer. There are usually people who are one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Michael Jackson's probably the closest thing we've had to someone who was sort of mm-hmm. a virtuoso at both of those things. I came away from that with a really, like, a much deeper appreciation for her as a performer and how difficult it is to even be in that place today, right? I mean, there are people who are pop stars, but there aren't people who still drive conversation the way she does. It felt that everyone was having this incredibly intimate experience with her,
yeah.
right? She's like, mm-hmm. she's like, I'm so glad to be here, and you know, I've waited for this moment my whole life. I've always gone to a stadium tour and everyone was like, we love you, girl. I mean, it felt like everyone was like, everyone knew all the words. It was just a fantastic experience. And it's, you know, it's cost prohibitive because of the stadium tour, but if you can see Beyonce while she's at the peak of her powers, you should
nice.
Avail yourself of the opportunity.
How did Lemonade translate to a stadium setting? I mean, you talked about, like, the intimacy. Like, that's a very, very intimate record
sure.
in a very non-intimate setting. Like,
yeah, you're right. I mean, there's this gigantic four-story cube that is, like, a HD screen, and it's, like, spinning around, and, like, there's all the stuff behind her. It's a lot of stuff from, like, Beyonce and a lot of stuff, like, even Destiny's Child. And she's really charming. Like, she's really charming. She bats her eyelashes. She's like, guys, I'm just... And she's like, this is my favorite song from this album. You know,
mm-hmm.
as if she's, like, in a little... She's, like,
little
picked
club.
Up a guitar, like, on a stool.
Yeah.
Like, this little song, a little ditty I'm going to play you.
Yep.
Called Freedom. No, but she's fantastic. And, again, if you can see Beyonce when she comes to your town, you should avail yourself of the opportunity.
That's great. Nice. I've been following that tour very closely because I follow DJ Khaled on Snapchat.
Oh, he's so funny and so good. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was Aisha Harris from Slate who mm-hmm. said, who asked on Twitter, why does DJ Khaled have a DJ? And I said, DJ Khaled has one of everything, including a DJ. Anyway, thank you very much, Gene Demby. W. Kamau Bell's new show on CNN, which is called United Shades of America. I feel like such a jerk that I did not get on this train sooner. I started watching these over the weekend. They are so interesting. He is such an interesting dude. And he went, you know, in the first episode, he went down to kind of visit with the new Klan. And he goes to what they call a cross-lighting. And he talks to them. It's
very brand aware.
The show is a fascinating mix of, it is sometimes funny, but it's not, he is not looking at these things fundamentally ironically. He is fundamentally trying to get to the bottom of something. And yet he's very funny. And when he is dealing with, it sounds strange to say, a slightly lighter topic like San Quentin, but that is kind of true. He goes and visits San Quentin, which has become a prison that's known now for being very desirable for prisoners, according to his reporting, because they have a lot of rehabilitation programs and because they're very heavily into projects that try to give people meaning. The episode about San Quentin is extraordinary. He has an episode about policing that he did primarily in Camden, New Jersey, which is extraordinary. I really have been extremely impressed with this show. I think it's one of those things where if it weren't on CNN, where it's a little bit weird brand-wise for them, you'd be hearing probably a lot more about it than maybe people have heard. It's called United Shades of America. It's W. Kamau Bell, who you might know from Totally Biased and other stuff. Boy, do I think that show is great. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE 215. And don't forget, Gene's on a new podcast that's called Code Switch.
That's right.
You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to Audie for being with us for our quiz segment, and we will see you back here next week.
Check out the NPR One app for your phone. You can use it to listen to Pop Culture Happy Hour, and it's a great way to find tons of new shows and stories, too. Great hand-curated podcasts and stories that are always ready when you are on NPR One. Find it in your app store, NPR One.